Welcome. So welcome to our recording of a bit of an extension of last Sunday night's evening service at Highfields Church. Whether you were at that service or not, you're very welcome to be listening in. My name's Anthony Williams. I serve as one of the elders at Highfields Church, and it's a real joy and delight to have my friend Idris Baker with me, where we're hopefully going to pick up on some of the questions that we didn't get round to answering in our Q&A last Sunday evening. If you didn't get a chance to watch that service, please do go and check that out. I think it'd be really, really helpful. So the Highfields Church website or the Highfields YouTube page, the service is on there. That was on the 20th of October. So please do go and check that out if you want. But yeah, we're hopefully going to spend these next few minutes just having a look at some of the questions that came up. And maybe some of the broader themes that maybe we didn't get a chance to think and chat about, just in a little bit more detail, because we think that might be helpful for those who are there, or for anyone else. If you weren't there, you're very welcome to be listening in as well. I just want to stop and welcome Idris. Idris, how are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. Delighted to be here, loving this conversation, because there were so many great questions we could see coming up on the screen last Sunday evening and just didn't have time to get to. So it's great to have had a few days to reflect on some of those and to have a chance to talk together about some of those important questions.
Fab. Obviously, we heard a bit about you last Sunday evening, but for those who weren't there, just please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I work as a palliative medicine consultant, so that's dealing with adults with serious illnesses, primarily progressive life-shortening illnesses, supporting them, supporting the people close to them, whether that's family members, whoever it might be that's close and important to them, and doing that as part of a specialist team so that we're able to support the other clinical staff who are involved in their patients' care. In my case, that involves mainly seeing people who are at home. Sometimes that might be in a care home. But I work as part of a department with other people who are looking after the inpatients on our ward at the department and helping look after patients in the acute hospitals as well. So part of an integrated team. And that's most of what I spend my time doing. And then alongside that, I get to work doing a little bit of teaching in and around palliative care and ethics and a role in helping support the strategic development of how we do this kind of work in Wales. So that's a part of how I fill my week. And then outside of work, I'm involved with Town Hill Baptist Church in Swansea. I've been there for some time. Sarah and I serve there. And you know, great to be able to be in fellowship with other believers so that when it comes to grappling with difficult questions, as we must and should do, that we're not doing that in a complete vacuum, but that we're able to do that in fellowship within our own church and, of course, with believers elsewhere, like in this conversation.
Yeah. And just to say again, we're really grateful for you giving your time and effort last Sunday evening, and thank you for your time now in chatting with us.
It's a pleasure to be talking.
Before we dive into our questions, just wanted to ask, what drew you to palliative care?
I got inspired, actually, as a medical student, so quite early on. I was in my early 20s, and I had a single encounter with someone I never met, but he lectured us once. Now, he was a well-known Christian. He was at the end of his career, but he was a professor of pharmacology, and he told us about two things in that one lecture, and one of them was the science of using painkillers, and I was interested in that because I'd already been studying that stuff a bit. So he got my attention, and then he veered suddenly into talking about prescribing, being about human engagement, not really being primarily about signing a piece of paper, although you might have to do that, but really about the human engagement. Why on earth would people take the tablets you give them? Well, they do because there's some sort of trust that you have built up in that human engagement. And he brought those two things together then abruptly in the context of the care of the dying. And my experience of that was almost like a beam of light. I know what seat I was in the lecture theatre, and spent some years after that testing the sense I had that I was already a Christian at the time. I've been a Christian since I was a teenager and had a sense that maybe that was the thing that I was being called to do with the professional bit of my life, at least. And you know, it takes sometimes some years, doesn't it, to test, as we should, whether we've got the right instincts there. But a series of things over subsequent years, and really up to the present, have continued to confirm and reconfirm my sense that that was what I was meant to be doing. And I'm very thankful to be in a job that not only I enjoy, and I do, and I don't want to sound pious about this, I just love it for my own sake, but also a job that I'm increasingly sure, as the years go by, is the one I'm called to do by a God I know and by a God who I believe has purposes for his people's lives.
Thank you. That's really helpful. And hopefully we'll get a chance to pick up on some of those reflections there as we go on. But I suppose, picking up on where we left from Sunday evening. So Sunday evening, we were it was obviously our evening service, our time of worship, but we were spending some time thinking very specifically about how we can care for those who are maybe coming towards the end of their lives. What does the Bible say about that? What does God say about that? Well, what does he want us as Christians, as his church, to be doing? But also in the context of where we are at the moment in wider society. And we touched on quite a few things in our evening service. And as we said then, I suppose I just want to stop and say now that some of the things we might get onto talking about are difficult things. They're difficult things because they're complicated and they force us to think about lots of different areas of life, but they're also difficult because they're emotionally resonant for a lot of us a lot of the time, whether past experiences or experience we're going through now, or worries about what we might have for the future. And so although we are just two of us here now, we know that the questions that were written in, we don't know who they were written in by, but we know they're real questions from real people. And yeah, we want to, as best as we can, keep that right in the forefront of our mind as we answer, you say.
Indeed. Yes. I mean, it's really important that I'm assuming, as I do in any conversation, I'm assuming that I'm not the only person who's had experience of serious illness. I have, as it happens, fairly recently. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming I'm not the only person who's had some experience of grief of one sort or another. I'm assuming I'm not the only person who's known people close to them who've been very, very directly affected by very difficult and distressing experiences, including experiences, and it may have some relevance to some of the things we talk about, experiences of suicide. We should never forget the personal challenge that brings. We should never neglect the very intense and intimate personal nature of some of the content of what we're talking about. Nonetheless, there are important and difficult questions, and it would be tempting maybe to shy away from those, but I think it's right that we don't, right that instead we find opportunities to consider them openly.
And I suppose thinking then about where we find ourselves at the moment in our society, from thinking about the kind of UK maybe perspective, where for those who haven't been following the news or hearing about what might be happening in Westminster or in the Senedd just this week, where do we find ourselves at the moment?
Well, we find ourselves in a place where the UK, as many people listening may know, the UK has been for the last half century or a little bit more really in a leading position worldwide in developing the understanding, the knowledge and the provision of good care for people with serious and progressive life-shortening illnesses, what you might call palliative care, end-of-life care, terminal care. It gets called various things. It doesn't matter too much. Developing the knowledge about that, developing the science of it, developing the understanding about what works and what approaches can be taken in a way that helps people. And at the same time, across different parts of the UK, there have been a number of attempts to make that more equitable. So you may know that the Westminster Parliament, so this is law that's relevant specifically to England, recently passed an amendment to a health bill which conferred on NHS bodies a statutory duty to make sure that there is provision of palliative care for the populations they serve. That's a wonderful thing. That's England specific, but in different parts of the UK, the same principle is enacted in different ways. Hmm. And so in Wales, we have the opportunity to work alongside government and work alongside the NHS to make sure that whoever needs that kind of approach in their care has an opportunity to benefit from it. Now, passing laws about it, having government policies about it, doesn't always actually make it happen. So there is work to do. And I have to be very honest, we have a long, long way to go to make sure that everybody who needs that gets it. So that's part one of our context, is the continuing work to evolve the provision of the right care for people with those serious illnesses. And look, that's on a backdrop of medicine and perhaps healthcare in general over the previous decades having neglected to do that, having really taken its eye off the ball and thought, we're here for the things we can cure and fix, and that's great and it's exciting, and really taken its eye off the ball about the need to provide really great medical care for the people with illnesses we can't fix. And society had fallen into something of the same trap, so neglecting to pay attention to it. And we've seen something of this big societal movement to pay real attention to it. It's a very positive thing, and it's a positive thing because there is so much of great importance, great value that can be done in helping people living with those serious illnesses and helping the people who are close to them. And this has benefits really for the whole of society. There's a second part of the context, and again, people may have seen coverage of bits of it in the news. So not for the first time, there is a proposal currently in the Westminster Parliament, and this would affect the law in England and Wales because it's concerned with the criminal law, a proposal to change the law on assisting suicide. Now, this gets a little bit technical, but the history is that historically in the UK, it was unlawful to attempt suicide. So you had this Byzantine and I think cruel situation where you would, if you failed in an attempt to take your life, you might be prosecuted for it. And I think it's right that that law was changed 60 years ago, just over 60 years ago. And so the decision was made by Parliament to decriminalise it. So if you had an attempt to take your life and didn't succeed, then, you know, you need a response to that very distressing situation. And that response no longer includes being prosecuted for it.
Yeah.
I thank God for that. I mean that most seriously. Yeah. However, very deliberately, Parliament left on the statute a prohibition on assisting someone else to end their life, what's known in law as assisted suicide. And I appreciate that that language feels a bit confrontational to some people, and some campaigners would prefer that we didn't use it. But that is the language used by the law as it stands. There is a prohibition on assisting a suicide, and it's regarded as a serious criminal offence. Now, the reality of how that law is applied is that the criminal justice system recognises the difficult circumstances in which family members, for instance, might have found themselves. And so very often the authorities decide not to make a prosecution where a complaint is made that someone may have assisted a suicide. And again, personally, I think that's it is right that we temper the workings of the justice system with mercy, particularly in distressing circumstances. But nonetheless, that law is on the statute, and it's on the statute books for the good reason that there are some instances where someone might assist a suicide, where Parliament has continued to decide, and it's reaffirmed this decision each time it's had an opportunity to consider changes to the law, most recently 9 years ago, where Parliament has decided it should actually be an offence, because for someone like me to have a pattern of colluding with people in an attempt to end their lives would not be what we expect of our doctors. Now, what we have at the moment is a proposal to change the law on that so that in particular circumstances, that would no longer be an offence. I say particular circumstances. If I'm sounding vague about that, it's because the bill, which has had its first reading in the Commons, has not yet been published in full. So it's not completely clear what those circumstances would be. But it seems to be that it would be limited to people who are living with a terminal illness, in other words, a life-shortening illness, and where their survival is expected to be 6 months or less. Sidebar to that, it's really difficult to predict whose survival is going to be 6 months or less. We know that our ability to do that, the very best ability to do that, is not of great accuracy. So that's one of the practical challenges, but we expect that's going to be one of the details in the bill when it is brought before the House of Commons in November 2024, where there may be a vote on it. It's there as a private member's bill, and so there is a lot of conversation happening about that proposal at the moment. Since we met on Sunday night, of course, we've had a debate in the Senedd, Senedd Cymru, in Wales, the legislative body in Wales, which had a motion before it proposing that the Senedd should support and affirm the principles of that bill in the Commons. And the Senedd actually decided not to. It was voted down. There's a reasonable margin against it. And you know, we may, over the coming weeks, understand a little bit more clearly why members of the Senedd decided that. My instinct is that it's because so little detail has yet been provided as to what the Commons will be considering. And there's real concern about passing laws when you haven't got the detail and then leaving ministers and officials to write the detail in afterwards. We know that doesn't always go well, and that's arguably not a very safe way to change laws, even if one thought that that was a direction in which the law should go. So that's where we are at the moment.
Incredibly helpful, Idris, and, you know, like you said, it can sometimes be quite technical. So distilling that down is enormously helpful. Something else that we can sometimes get a little bit confused by are the different terms. You referred to assisted suicide there. You know, we obviously might hear about assisted dying. That's the name of the bill. Euthanasia is another term that comes up. What would be your sort of headline definitions of those terms, and how would we use them? Are they interchangeable?
So assisting suicide is really what it says on the tin. Suicide is intentionally taking one's life. Assisting a suicide, therefore, is intentionally helping someone to intentionally do that. Assisted dying is a term which is used at the moment by proponents of a change in the law where it applies to people living with a life-shortening illness. And they argue that in that context, what is being done doesn't really count as a suicide. They say it's because the person is dying anyway. In a sense, it has to be regarded as assisting a suicide because that is what the law currently regards it as. And there is an argument about whether, in fact, that the fact that the person's living with a serious illness, does that mean that taking their life before it would otherwise have ended no longer counts as a suicide? To me, I have to say that feels like it's marginalising people living with serious illness a little bit, and to say that the premature ending of their lives is different is in some way lesser. But that's the case that's put by proponents for a change in the law. Mm. Euthanasia, in contrast, isn't about someone ending their own lives. Euthanasia is about where someone else ends a person's life. For instance, a doctor does something, maybe gives a lethal injection to cause the end of a person's life. If you'll allow me to be blunt and call a spade, where someone comes in and kills a person. I mean, that's sometimes what we have to bluntly call the ending of someone's life, isn't it? And that's practiced in some jurisdictions, the Netherlands and in Belgium, that there has been for some years now the practice of voluntary euthanasia. In other words, that's at the person's request. And you can only call it euthanasia if it's thought to be in that person's interests. If I kill someone because I don't like them or because it's in my interests, well, you can't call that euthanasia. It has to be regarded as in a person's interests. There's a bit of a philosophical conundrum about whether it can, in fact, be in a person's interests to have their life ended. But some people clearly feel that that is the case. And so that's what the term euthanasia has taken to mean. And of course, there is also the practice, not least in the Netherlands and Belgium, of euthanasia, which is not voluntary. I would argue that some of the life-ending treatments that are used in neonates are a form of involuntary euthanasia, or perhaps you could say non-voluntary euthanasia. Dutch law doesn't call it euthanasia because they're severely ill neonates, in other words, severely ill, very young children within the first year of life. I don't think there's really any meaningful distinction that means we shouldn't call that euthanasia. I think it is a form of euthanasia. And then likewise, in the Netherlands and sometimes in Belgium, there have been instances of life-ending actions, life-ending treatments that amount to euthanasia in people who are not able at the time to make that request or give their consent because their illness has made them unable to do so. But people who have previously asked, so for instance, someone with living with dementia, who said early in their illness, if I ever get really bad, I would like you to do something to end my life. And then they get really bad and a doctor comes in and does something to end their life. And that you would have to call non-voluntary euthanasia because they're not consenting at the time. They're arguably, it's an action that's based on their previous wishes. I know of at least one case that went to a court review in the Netherlands where the woman in question was actively fighting off the five members of staff who came to do that. And there's a little bit of a doubt in my mind about whether that was still what she actually wanted at the time it was done.
Hmm. And you've mentioned a few jurisdictions that have legalised some form of euthanasia or assisted suicide. What's your take on the data from these jurisdictions in terms of how the practice has changed or developed, if at all, since they've changed the law in those places?
Well, in most of them, it has continued to develop and change, and particularly where it's been introduced for very limited populations. And this might be relevant to the bill which is going to be brought to the House of Commons, where that's then been extended so that it's been made available to other people. Someone might say, look, my neighbour who's got a six-month prognosis and is suffering unbearably has been allowed to do this, but because I'm not living with a six-month prognosis, my unbearable suffering disqualifies me. That's not fair. That kind of argument has been made, for instance, in the Netherlands and in Belgium and also more recently in Canada. And so the provisions have been extended to enable them to be applied to many more people. And that's one of the reasons why the proportion of deaths which are under these regulated systems has continued then to grow. Some of the safeguards have varied a little bit as well. So that's not so much by changing the statute, it's by how rigorously they're implemented. So as an example, there is meant to be in some jurisdictions checks to make sure that the person isn't living with untreated depression, an untreated depressive illness. And we know, for instance, in Oregon, there's a significant proportion of people, this is just in the reported data, who may well have had an undiagnosed depressive illness. You can establish that by looking back at the records. Just from the things that have been identified about the patient, it's possible to look back and say, hang on, this person may well have had an unrecognized depressive illness. There may be more than that, where nothing's been written down about the symptoms of that. So we know that those things over time don't always consistently get applied. And there's a third thing, and again, you can see it particularly in the data from the Netherlands. It's often claimed that if you have a legal system, that a system that legalises actions to end a person's life, at least then you can regulate it, which means you won't have it being done in an unregulated way. Well, we know from the data in the Netherlands that more people have what's euphemistically called life-ending action without explicit request. In other words, no one asked for it, no one recorded they were doing it, but the review of the notes afterwards can show that what was doing was the doctor thought, actually, this person needs to have their life ended, and that was done. And it was done maybe with good intent, maybe with an attempt to justify on compassionate grounds, but nonetheless being done. And that's a bigger proportion, a bigger number of deaths than under the regulated system. Mm-hmm. So what the data do tell us is that things don't stand still. Safeguards are not left uneroded. That is a reality in most jurisdictions. And unregulated practice does not, in fact, stop simply because you introduce some legal regulation. Mm.
And possibly that the unregulated activity increases because there's a wider acceptance of practices more generally.
Wider acceptance by society, wider acceptance probably by professionals, right? Wider acceptance by the system, greater familiarity with the emotion of the act of injecting poisonous medication. All of these things probably contribute to that, yes.
Mm-hmm. I suppose this is why I want to bring us to our first couple of questions that were posed to us and didn't get to on Sunday evening in our service, which I suppose is thinking about, well, why any of this is wrong, I suppose, when we think about it as Christians, as we think about it, maybe as people who aren't Christians. However we think about it, we've talked about these terms, euthanasia, assisted suicide. We've talked about whether the law counts certain things as legal or illegal. Why is any of this wrong? And a couple of the questions we had, firstly, if you do kill yourself, is there any chance that you would go to heaven? It's obviously a really poignant and tricky question for us to think about. And another one, similarly, if suicide is sinful because it goes against God's timing, would someone in pain nearing death dying by suicide, consider this actually God's time for them. What are your thoughts on those questions?
I mean, look, my thoughts on that have to start with the thing you graciously acknowledged at the start of this conversation, that we're dealing with difficult stuff here. I really hesitate to jump on the idea of suicide and label it as a thing which is sinful. And you know, that there are real complexities around that. A lot of the people who experience that inclination, that thought about ending their lives, are people who are experiencing serious illness, serious mental illness in many cases. And a lot of them are people who, whether it's in the context of illness or whatever other things going on in their lives, are experiencing some of the most intense distress and distress that maybe some of us have not experienced. Mm. And I think it's desperately important that we start by saying, look, I'm not going to jump on that in the abstract and put labels on it without understanding it. And that's a thing which has often been done. Mm. And, you know, we could sit back. I mean, there's vast literature on the morality, the moral theology of these questions, and there's ample opportunity to dig into it. But I think I'm going to start by saying, look, I'm going to resist that labelling a little bit. Mm. But part of what we talked about on Sunday night was, how do we start? Where do we start for trying to understand these questions? Now, look, I think it's great that the way you framed the question acknowledges that whatever we believe, whether or not you're a Christian listening to this, I would think there are very good reasons actually to think that the kind of change in the law I've described that is proposed is not actually the right way to go. And some of the most compelling arguments, I think, to resist this particular change are nothing to do with one's Christian faith, I believe. And so we have these conversations with people who share my faith, but people who don't share my faith. And we have remarkably similar perspectives on that, to do with society's collective need to acknowledge the worth of persons and for that to be undiminished by the effects of serious illness. If I were to phone someone up this evening and say I'm considering ending my life, then there are quite rightly a series of protections which can swing into place to help to guard me from acting on that. And the reason we think as society that's important is, you know, that there are deep and complex reasons, but it's a thing that is generally accepted. I'm just not convinced that for someone living with a serious illness, that should be any different. So that's your general point. But look, that this conversation is particularly to help us think about, well, why particularly would Christians have a distinct perspective on this, which I think we do, in addition to those non-faith-based reasons. And look, my starting point, and it's what we were throwing around on Sunday evening in conversation, my starting point is that if I'm sitting here saying I'm a Christian, I am, that means saying Jesus is Lord. Hmm. Christ's lordship is at the centre of what it means to identify with his name. Because you can't have him in some sense without having him as Lord. If he's not Lord of all, he's not Lord at all. Yeah. I mean, these familiar kind of pieces of language, but they carry great significance. And the point about his Lord is that it is singular and definitive. It's not a Lord alongside some other lords. And I would be one of the people who does not sit alongside him as Lord of my life. If Jesus is Lord, I believe he is, then he's Lord of my life, and I am not. And I think that really matters. In other words, the way I approach important questions about my own life, this is my starting point, is recognizing his lordship, is recognizing, in other words, the sovereignty of God. When I talk about Jesus, I'm talking about the Son of God, who is God himself, the Lord Jesus Christ. And so this is about the sovereignty of God. What I mean by sovereignty, I mean he's in charge. Okay, so it's that foundational idea. And that means that decisions I make about my life, I'm not to make pretending that I'm somehow in charge of it. Now, how do I then apply that more widely to this kind of big societal question? Well, it means that I should see other people. If I'm saying I'm a believer, and I'm talking now specifically as a Christian, thinking about how I should understand the treatment of other people around me, how should I, what public policy should I as a Christian think should be enacted? I shouldn't be seeing other people other than through the eyes of God. How does God see them? Well, we know that God made people in his image. They're not the same as God, but made in his image. What does that mean? Well, what does it mean for each of us? Well, it means what the Bible says. It means love your neighbour. And so the people who first heard Jesus say this said, well, who's my neighbour? And they might have expected him to say the person who's like you, the person next to you. And Jesus' answer in the parable of the Good Samaritan makes it really clear. It's not necessarily who you thought it was. And you kind of have to assume it's whoever you encounter. And he was talking there about an encounter on a road in first century Palestine. But we encounter people in all sorts of ways. Now, we interact with people all over the country and all over the world in different ways. And this is why we have responsibilities for how we treat people, including, I think, people we never meet. So each time we're thinking, what should society do about this question? We're thinking about it through that lens. What does it mean to love this person? Now, it doesn't mean to say, no, you can't have the thing you want, and I'm now going to turn away and neglect you in your suffering. So it means we've got to engage with the people of suffering around us, however we are given the opportunity to do that. And that will vary between different people. Okay, I've got a particular set of professional opportunities to engage with people suffering, but we all do to some extent. But it will also mean lots of other things. It will mean lots of things. And so there's a duty for the Christian to think, what does it mean to love my neighbour when my neighbour may be suffering, when my neighbour may be someone who is suffering in the future? How do I engage with the people around me? And how do I engage with them in a way that contributes to their sense of how their life retains that value which is put in it at creation, put in it when they are first formed by God, by the God who created all of us and who says, I've created them in my image. What does it mean to deal with people, to engage with people in a way which supports them in sustaining that sense of value in the face of the onslaught in a fallen world of illness and distress and suffering, which can seem to rob it of that value? And we see it constantly. We see it constantly in people who are ill and suffering, that it feels like life no longer has value. And I don't find it remotely surprising that some of those people think, well, my life, it would be better if my life just ended now. I think that's completely unsurprising, in fact, in light of the things that some people experience. So the question for the Christian is, well, how can I engage with any and all of these people that I'm given the opportunity to engage with in a way that resists that sense that life can no longer have any value? Not only does it not now, but that it never will have. Because that's not how God sees us and not how God sees it. Now, that's got to be the starting point. Now, in general, I think Christians would also have, I think should have, real concern about laws that expose people to unnecessary dangers. And I think that there really can be no question from the data in other jurisdictions that when you enact this kind of thing with good intentions, I'm putting good in air quotes there, with good intentions to limit it to a very small number of people who most need it, that the provisions in most jurisdictions then get extended to other people. And you look at the way that's unfolded and you see people in Canada living with the experience of disability and struggling to get the right housing and going for help with their housing and told, no, we can't fund that, we can't afford it, but here's a piece of information about medical assistance in dying, as it's known in Canada. So, you know, again, these are the realities in other jurisdictions. The way then this duty to engage with the distress and suffering of the people around us, the way that translates into how we should see public policy, I think surely has to include, well, don't do that. Engage with people in a way that doesn't do that and that doesn't just say no. So I think the Christian has a duty to be concerned about the housing of someone living with disability who, when she can't be provided with the right housing, feels like her life should end now. Love your neighbour means be concerned about that. And if you've got an opportunity to change that, then do something to change that. It can't just be a just don't allow this one thing, but it's got to include, no, I'm not going to support you in changing the law in such a way that colludes with a person in the midst of that distress in thinking, yeah, frankly, you're right. Your life isn't worth anything anymore. It may as well end now. And we will somehow license a state-provided system to bring it to an end. because we haven't done the other things that would have changed it, that would have changed your circumstances and restored for your future some sense of the value which can be there in your lives. We see that value lived out in people with very serious illnesses and very short lives ahead of them. We see nonetheless the value of that life being lived out, and the people who by their circumstances are brought to feel that value is now irretrievably lost. It's not for the state, it's not for society to collude and shrug and say, yeah, you're probably right, you might as well go now.
And I suppose thinking about why or how this might apply in other slightly more greyer areas, maybe we've had a question, I suppose, on the same theme: is a DNR or DNA CPR sinful? So, do you just want to sort of quickly define what DNA CPR is, and then I suppose reflect on why is having treatment that stops the end of your life a good thing? If actually we're thinking about God's timing and God being sovereign over all of our days, should we be forestalling that?
So let's start at the end of the question. As you say, God has his timing and has his will and has his plans, and his will be done, and we pray that it will be done. And sometimes his will involves, by a range of different means, treatment for serious illness, which is effective in preventing from dying someone who would otherwise have died of it. And again, we can thank God for that. I've been on the receiving end of that, and I've known other Christians in the last few months also on the receiving end of that. And we can be thankful for that specifically because God's will is being done in it. Just as in a different way, we can be thankful that when a believer does die, that they go to be with him forever and the suffering is gone. So we can be thankful that his will is done in that. Now, that's the general answer. Performing CPR is just a specific form of that. So CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, a treatment invented, what, about 60 years ago now, that can be used when someone's heart stops, and that threatens, obviously, to make the rest of their body stop. It's a treatment that can restart it by correcting the thing that made it stop, and then you can treat whatever the underlying condition is. And it's a treatment that works great in particular circumstances, and it was done to a good friend of mine just a few weeks ago who would absolutely have died that morning had it not been done. And it's a treatment that also doesn't work in other conditions. And the way one of my colleagues, I think it's a really great way to see it. If the heart is the first thing to go, then restarting it might work. If the heart is the last thing to stop, because now your body is dying because of the effects of an illness, and eventually that means that every last bit of your body goes, including your heart stopping, then in that situation, attempting to restart your heart, because common sense tells you that's not going to work. And that common sense is borne out by the ample evidence. People who are dying, CPR doesn't work. And so what's sometimes called a DNR, more properly known as DNA CPR, do not attempt cardiopulmonary resuscitation, is a recognition usually of that reality, that it just won't work. And there are a few things in medicine where you can say that confidently. And I think it's completely clear, if there's any kind of basis as a Christian to be involved in providing medical treatment, that we should be providing treatments that work and not those that don't work. And so we shouldn't be doing CPR to someone where it is not going to work at all. And a decision in advance that recognises that, so you're not having to decide it in a crisis, is much better than facing that crisis. For other people, it's decided because even if there's a small chance of it working, they would not want it because the burden of it would be massive. And again, I think that's completely legitimate. That's not someone who's wanting to die. That someone is recognising that for them it wouldn't be the right treatment. A lot of people who have it breaks a lot of their ribs, and it can take you a long time, months, sometimes years, to get over the pain of broken ribs. And so, for some people, it is right that it's decided, look, I would not want this treatment, and I'm going to ask in advance that you don't do it. And it's absolutely not. However concerned we are, as we should be, for people's lives, we don't get to overrule their own understanding in their own lives that this would not be the right treatment for them. So those are the two reasons it's typically done. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, and certainly nothing that you could remotely call sinful. In fact, I think you would start to veer to the sinful if you start doing what amounts to an assault on a person by doing a treatment they don't want or a treatment that isn't going to work. That's going to take some justifying, not the withholding the treatment that isn't going to work. Just as I say that, I realise I slightly accidentally failed to answer an earlier bit of one of the earlier questions, and I wonder if I could just come back to it, because we talked about sin in a different context of suicide. There was another part to that question, which I think was about if suicide is sinful, and then, you know, is there any chance that you'll go to heaven? I mean, look, I'll keep this one short, but what that really gets us into as territory is, well, how do I get to heaven? Listen, I'll let you into a secret. Well, it's not a secret in this conversation, I know, but you don't get to heaven based on what you've done or not done. Because no one except the Lord Jesus Christ has ever lived a perfect life, and that's the life that would qualify you for heaven. So no one, I promise you this, no one listening to this is ever going to get into heaven based on what they've done. And that kind of means that no one's going to fail to get into heaven based on what they've done. You get into heaven, if you get into heaven, by being forgiven, because all of us, the Bible's very clear about this, all of us have sinned, and any sin at all, however minor it seems to you, is an affront in the nostrils of God and is easily enough to stop you ever getting into heaven, except that by the grace of God, we can be forgiven if we turn and repent and believe in the Lord Jesus Christ because of his death on the cross, taking the punishment so that I don't have to, and that's what not getting to heaven would entail. Now, that's how you get to heaven. It's not based on having lived well enough, because if it was, I promise you, heaven would be empty apart from God himself and the beings he's created to be there. So, no is the short answer. Now, there's a bit of mystery there. How can you be forgiven for the last thing you do in your life? But God is good and gracious. And once he has saved you and you are forgiven of all your sins, then nothing can rip you from his hand, including, I have no doubt, death by suicide. So I appreciate it's a bit of a digression, but it just came back to my mind that we hadn't talked about it before. It feels important.
Yeah. And I suppose the kind of outflow of that is that actually in the security of knowing that whatever we do or have done or don't do, haven't done, God is going to keep us safe. That means we've got the freedom and the confidence to actually think about these things really, really carefully. Because, yes, God has revealed himself to us, and he's revealed how he wants us to live. And so it's in that confidence of his salvation for us, in what he's done for us, that it means that we can think about these things and begin to say anything about the rightness and wrongness of some of these things.
And only because of that, absolutely. Otherwise, it would be a very dry moral philosophical exercise, and that can be great fun if you're into that, but it doesn't actually get us where we need. Thank you.
And I suppose, just coming back to the DNA CPR, because this is the kind of thing that does make it into the news from time to time, doesn't it? The kind of thing that we heard about a bit during the COVID pandemic, that the use of DNA CPR forms or orders, which basically a piece of paper that sort of suggests that you've made this decision, because you were talking earlier about value and the value of someone's life. And I think sometimes we hear that people think that they have had a DNA CPR order or a decision made on their life because it's felt as though their life is not worth living. You've obviously explained really clearly how the decision should be made. In reality, what's your sense as to how DNA CPR decisions are made more generally?
My experience of it, I don't know whether it's typical. My experience of it is that it is made, in fact, on the kind of basis I've outlined, that a decision is made not to do it because it won't work, or because the person doesn't want it, or the harm would be disproportionate, or any combination of those things. You've got a slightly separate question about how it's communicated.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the difficulties you've alluded to there are, in fact, because of how decisions are communicated. In other words, a decision that's been made in exactly the right way hasn't always been communicated as clearly as it should be. And in communicating it, you've got to recognise a lot of noises off get in the way of that. So the TV depiction, for instance, TV medical dramas, don't you love them? And they depict how CPR works, and it's not completely accurate. And so if a person has been left with that as the impression of how it works, well, we've got a bit of work to do to help the person to understand what's being talked about here. And I like to think that we're getting better over time at communicating really clearly in a way that allows people the opportunity to be involved in decisions about their care insofar as it's right for them to do so. Some people prefer to back off from these decisions and leave them with the professionals. Well, that's fine. Other people prefer to be more intimately involved. I think I would be one of those if we were talking about me, but who knows? So I hope we're getting better over time at making sure that there's the right opportunity for people to be engaged in that so that they are not left with that misapprehension about what's being decided here, which can be so damaging of their own sense of how they're being treated, so damaging of trust. And it's really important that we don't deal with people in a way that stops them trusting.
I suppose communication is so important, isn't it? And you know, I've seen great strides in the last sort of 10 years in how we communicate some of these decisions. But I think we don't always get it right, do we?
Of course we don't. I like to think we get it badly wrong less often than we used to. You've got rising expectations as well. Yeah. And I think it's right that we pay attention to those and try to meet those. And so that's the ongoing effort. Try to get it right.
Yeah. A follow-up question, I suppose, to the DNA CPR question, you know, should we be accepting treatment that would delay the end of our lives? DNA CPR is a little bit, actually a little bit binary. You know, often it's clear that it won't work. Sometimes it's not. And then there are lots of other treatments like that, where we might think this dose of chemotherapy, these antibiotics, they may or may not help this person live longer. There's obviously the question about living better as well. Why would someone saying, no, I'm not going to have your life-sustaining treatment, not be the same as assisted suicide, assisted dying?
Well, quite simply, because they're not intending to die sooner as a result. Now, that may or may not be the effect. You might assume it's the effect if you don't go ahead with this life-sustaining treatment. You might think, well, then the person's definitely going to die sooner. But, of course, it's not always the case, because a lot of these treatments we're talking about are really high stakes. And if they're given in the right way to the right person who's in the right kind of condition, they can really work and they can really help and dramatic benefits. And if they're given to someone who's not fit for them, or who is just because of their health or their circumstances is just not in a position to take the onslaught the treatment involves, then the treatment's going to do more harm than good. And I think sometimes patients, when they express their view on these treatments, are expressing something quite profound, which may not be obvious on the surface, but which is actually telling us, no, this isn't the right treatment for me at this point. So it's really not clear that foregoing the treatment, that going without it, means that you're going to have a worse outcome. That person's probably going to have a better outcome. But the main thing is that it's nothing to do with them intending thereby for their life to end. And intention here can have a huge significance. Now, people will sometimes dispute that. Yeah. People will sometimes say, hang on, if you can foresee a thing happening, dying sooner because you don't go ahead with the treatment would be an example, then you go ahead with that decision, well, you must really have been intending it. People, and I can understand people saying that. But I'll tell you the kind of thing we do, the kind of thing I teach to students who have questions about this kind of thing, is what philosophers call a thought experiment. And so in that situation, you ask yourself, what if the thing I can foresee doesn't happen? Do I feel I've made the right decision? Do I feel I've made the wrong decision? Let's take that example. You don't have the chemotherapy, but you do recover for a little bit without the treatment. And we have to be honest, some people get a little bit better for a while without the treatment we could give, and they do better than they would have done with it. That's the reality for some patients. Not forever, but for a little while. What do you feel then if you're in that situation? The person who has gone without the chemo because they thought it wasn't the right treatment, they will take that good additional improvement as a bonus. They say, that's even better than I thought this would work out. If you had someone who is intending to cause a person's death by not using the treatment, they're going to feel thwarted. They're going to feel, I haven't achieved what I wanted to here. So now that sounds a bit stark, but it's a really useful thought experiment. It's one I use at the bedside when I'm making really tough decisions in the heat of the moment. It's one I use to think through decisions over the longer term, and a lot of colleagues use it as well. So the thing I'm putting significance on here that is different between not having treatment and between doing something that's designed to end your life is, well, what is it you intend? Yeah. And the people we encounter who decide not to have a treatment, or the colleagues who decide not to give a particular treatment, just like the CPR, what they're intending is not, in my experience, not to cause the end of the person's life. Now, look, if there are cases where someone does make a decision intending to cause the end of a person's life, then they have difficult questions to answer before their professional regulator and, if necessary, before the police. Yeah. And I think it is right that they should have to answer those tricky questions. But that's not, in my experience, what's actually happening. What's happening is that there's no intention for the person to die sooner as a result. And if they actually live longer associated with that decision, then that's an additional cause to celebrate and know that we've done the right thing here.
Yeah. And I think important to say that so often, I mean, there will be examples where this doesn't happen, but so often these kind of decisions, the ones that you've talked about, the should I have the chemotherapy, should I have this round of antibiotics or the intravenous fluids if you've got a serious infection, they're taken with a lot of thought, a lot of care, and hopefully with the person themselves right at the centre of it, expressing their wishes and preferences and being helped to decide what the right thing for them is.
Certainly insofar as they want to. And you know, recognising that some people just prefer to leave it to the professionals, but that's an individual thing.
And so it's very hard to have a list of things, a list of examples where you'd say this is obviously the right thing to do, this is obviously the wrong thing to do, because these are so specific to the individual person at the time. Yes, based on guidelines and data, but the fact that the intention, as you say, at the heart of it, is very difficult for someone, you know, away, not involved in those conversations, to be able to easily pinpoint that this is what was going on there. I think important for us to just remember that when we often have some of these conversations, particularly if we're thinking about the media or a lot of these conversations can be had in the abstract, where it's easy to say this was right or wrong.
That's why I'm resisting making some of the individual judgments here.
I suppose kind of following on from that, we had a few questions, really, really helpful questions on the way that sometimes things that we would often do very, very regularly in our daily practice within caring for people who are seriously unwell, the things that might be termed palliative care, why that isn't or how that can sometimes look like assisted suicide, assisted dying. So a couple of questions. What qualifies for euthanasia on the sliding scale? If it is not as black and white as they make out, why are they voting on a principle? So actually, are there lots of things that could or couldn't be a bit like euthanasia? Does, you know, and I think that this question speaks into that. Does pain control with morphine lead to the untimely death of a palliative patient? Is this therefore euthanasia? And similarly, when is a line crossed morally and clinically from providing pain relief and palliative care to assisting a suicide?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, for it to qualify as euthanasia, it's a simple matter of definition. You've got to intend to kill someone in their interests, and you've actually got to do so. And all of those three conditions are met. So if it's not in that person's interest, then it's some other form of homicide that's not euthanasia at all. If it's not intentional, huge significance. You know, every time a surgeon puts knife to skin and operates on someone, there is some risk of causing some harm. And for some operations in a real crisis, there's some risk that the patient isn't going to survive because of the operation. I mean, I don't want to dent anyone's confidence, but, you know, these are the realities in some of the really high-stakes situations. That doesn't mean that what the surgeon has done when she puts knife to skin is ever going to entail anything to do with euthanasia. You get the idea. The significance of intention is something we can't lose sight of, but so is the significance of the causation. And that's really what these questions are about. Now, it used to be assumed that using painkillers to help manage people's pain would, as a side effect, probably shorten their lives. That used to be widely believed, including by professionals. The UK has been at the forefront of generating the evidence on this question. Notably, I should just say in passing, work done by Robert Twycross, who died the other day, in fact, the day we met in Highfields. And someone who is missed for many reasons, but one of them is the work he led many years ago now to demonstrate that this approach to pain control is one that can be used safely and that doesn't, in fact, shorten people's lives. Now, that was a few decades ago. We should kind of get that by now, and I'm getting a little bit tired of professional colleagues who don't get that. But I don't blame at all the ongoing assumption in wider society. If there's still doctors talking as if painkillers shorten people's lives, then, well, the rest of us are somewhat inclined to believe that. If they're used well, they don't. Now, more recently, we can be even more confident than that, because more recently it's increasingly clear uncontrolled symptoms are really bad for your health. Pain control and control of other physical symptoms is better for your health than leaving them uncontrolled. And that's probably why people who get the right symptom control approach, as well as the right psychological support in progressive life-shortening illness, they live longer than the people who don't. I'll say it again. People who get good pain control live longer than people who don't. So in fact, this question in reality has kind of melted away as a thing that's of moral importance. We used to have to grapple with it when I was a student. Should I give these painkillers? I'm doing a good thing, but I might also be doing a bad thing. You know, for the most part, we don't need to worry about that anymore. Now, look, there may be high stakes, unusual situations where there's a bit of the two things being in tension, and those are always going to need really serious, weighty decision-making, but it's not the norm. If someone's treating someone's pain really well, it's good for their health and it's not going to kill them.
Yeah, and it's just so important to kind of double underline that, isn't it? Because like you said, it remains a really common thing to have to explain, to have to talk about. And, you know, I never tire of doing that because I think it's really, really great when you can help people to understand that these medications, used well, used with a bit of understanding, are really, really good for your health. Moving on to a couple of questions we had about specific conditions. There are certain conditions where some people will know that there are specific guidelines, some specific guidance about how end of life care should be approached in these situations. So the questions are, what is your view on euthanasia or removal of life preserving care in patients with prolonged disorders of consciousness? And similarly, have you any advice on how to approach locked in syndrome and similar conditions?
I mean, look, again, it's a few questions in that, isn't it? On the first part, look, the approach is kind of simple, that we shouldn't be making any of these decisions, including decisions about treatments stopping, including clinically assisted feeding, what's sometimes called artificial feeding stopping. We shouldn't be doing that because of an intention thereby to end the person's life. Okay, we shouldn't decide to stop something so as to end the person's life. And that's quite simple. And that's not merely opinion. That's the professional and regulatory consensus and is what the law in each part of the United Kingdom says. And in fact, the law in most jurisdictions. So why might we stop the feeding in someone with that sort of very serious long-term illness? Well, look, there is sometimes some controversy around the specifics, but the broad principles are actually pretty clear. You stop it if it's not helping, if it's doing more harm than good, and that can. And I mean, you know, you might think that something like artificial feeding is pretty harmless, and it isn't always. It's great when it works well, but it's not always harmless. Or because you know that it would have violated the wishes of the person if they were able to express them. Now, you've got to be careful with that one. How can you know exactly what a person would have wanted in this situation? I won't bore you with all of the detail of how one might establish that. It's codified in law and it's been thought through pretty carefully, with an emphasis on erring on the side of keeping the person alive where there's doubt, but also on respecting the wishes that a person had. And I think that's important because no means no. It's important that someone like me, just because I've got the power and authority of a senior doctor, that doesn't mean I get to barrel into your life and do stuff to you that you didn't want me to do. I think that's kind of important. I think that's kind of important as an expression of love your neighbour, actually, that I don't get to wade in and do stuff against your wishes simply because you're powerless to resist, as many seriously ill people are. So it's a really important balance, but it's got to be those principles and not intending that you end the person's life by doing it. You might foresee it, but that's not the intention. Think again about that thought experiment and how it might play out. So that's the feeding withdrawal. You're going to have to remind me the second part of your complex question.
Yeah, so I suppose similar but different, locked-in syndrome, yeah, was mentioned.
Really difficult. And look, the starting point for this has to be we recognise the value of the person who is still there in front of us, and that value is undiminished by the fact that this is someone who is no longer able to do all the things they used to be able to do and is not able to communicate with us in normal ways. And those are really the two things that in lay terms would be at the heart of describing a condition as locked in. They're not able to do much and they're not able to communicate with us. And those things do not diminish the value of this person. They change the experience of their life, but they don't diminish their value. As a very wise man used to say, it's not for no reason that we are called human beings and not human doings. In other words, the value is not in what things you're no longer able to do. So how do you interact with that person? Will you continue to consider what it is that's in their interests? Really interestingly, a study was done a few years ago now using some fancy brain scanning technology to try to work out what's going on inside the head of people who are locked in. And some of them, at least, they were able to get to a point where using the scanning technology, they were able to ask them questions. And not only that, because these are people who can often hear and think, and they were able to discern their answers instead of hearing a word in answer. Let's see which bit lights up on the brain scanner. And it's quite a complex process.
And that would be different from a prolonged disorder of consciousness.
Where they're not able to do any thinking anymore. Yeah. Absolutely. It's a crucial difference. Interestingly, these people who were completely dependent on nursing care for every function in life, and where you and I might look at them and think, gosh, your quality of life must be dreadful. And they got to a point where they could ask them that question. And a lot of them would say, you know what, my quality of life is better than you thought, because there's dignity in the great way you're caring for me. And I'm comfortable and I'm well looked after. And so, look, how should you approach someone who's locked in? Well, you've got to recognise that capacity for dignity. And got to think, you may not have access to that fancy brain scanning technology, but how can I deal with this person as a person and not just as a weakened body? And the difference there's fundamental. Love your neighbour.
And the diving bell and the butterfly described that experience,
yeah,
wasn't it?
You know? Beautifully done. And he dictated it all by blinking at letters on a letter chart, and his assistant interpreted that and wrote it down. He sadly died not long after completing it. But yeah, you know, it's great just to see there is still humanity, there is still human dignity, there is still human worth. And Jean-Dominique Bobby, who dictated that, has been able to touch the lives of lots of other people in a way you might assume someone who's locked in bed in a nursing home would never again be able to do. And he found he could.
Yeah. And you mentioned his assistant there, you know, the painstaking effort it would have been to translate that blinking. As you say, there is such wonderful demonstration of dignity in what they did.
Yes.
And the desire to come alongside and care for someone.
Yes.
Is just wonderful.
Yes. And just as an aside, anytime, whatever role you're in, if you're finding it difficult to play your part in the communication with someone whose communication is impaired, just keep in mind it's harder for them than it is for you. It was pretty arduous for Jean-Dominique in dictating that. But yeah, how wonderful in fact, that there was someone who could help give effect to those blinks, turn them into words that can then influence other people.
And an example of what is seen so often or experienced so often, isn't it, is all many forms of serious illness ultimately end up meaning you're isolated. You're isolated either because you can't communicate as well. Locked-in syndrome is a particularly significant example of that. But there's so many other, maybe more subtle ways in which you can become isolated. And so sometimes the people around you draw back because they don't know what to say, or they don't know if they're burdening you by trying to help you to speak and communicate because you can't get to the things that you used to. And this isolation is one of the things, I think, coming back to what you said earlier, makes people feel, well, my life doesn't have any meaning and value and worth anymore.
I think that's it. And you know, sociologists call it social death, and they don't mean the embarrassment after you do something silly at a party. They mean when you're no longer able to interact in established ways with the people around you. And this horrific idea that means you are as good as dead. Well, you're not as good as dead, in fact. Now, look, I think there's a direct challenge here. This isn't just an obtuse sociological question. There's a direct challenge for us. And again, let's bring it back to Christians and churches. How do we interact with the people around us who find themselves in diminished circumstances? How do we interact with the people who, because of a change, it might be a change in their health or a change in their social lives, whatever it might be, who might be coming towards a point where it can feel as if life doesn't have the value it did, doesn't have the dignity it did, where they might be coming towards a point where they think, well, life in the face of this progressive illness or whatever change it might be, no longer has value at all and can never have value again. What does love your neighbour mean in the light of that possibility, that thing that faces a lot of the people in society around us, including in our churches, in our communities, in our families as well? What does it mean? Well, it means never interacting with people in a way that fuels that sense of despair about the value that life can have now and in the future. And it means where we can, always interacting with them in a place, in a way, that continues to nurture the sense of dignity and value that life can in fact carry. Now, that's a demanding claim I'm making, and I get that. And we can't all always do all of it all of the time. You can only do what you can do. But we can at least consider all of the people around us, people we encounter, people we see, people we don't see, because they're no longer out there for us to see, but the people we know to be around us, in a way that at least asks us that question: what is there I can do today? What is there I can do this year which could, if I did it, make someone's life worse and therefore I should think about not doing? And what is there I can do today or this year, whenever it might be, that can actually help to nurture that sense of dignity, which can be nurtured, which can be maintained, which can be restored in people's lives in the face of the most difficult circumstances? And bringing this back particularly to thinking about this as Christians, and some of the conversations we've had in recent days, you know, what does the Christian do in the face of those experiences ourselves? Well, what does it say in Psalm 23 in such familiar words? You know, it doesn't say, well, I won't walk through the valley of the shadow of death, then will I, because you're with me. It says, even though I do. Yeah. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. This is addressing God. So, look, what can each of us do, whether it's about our own lives, whether it's about the lives of people around us, is we have this great privilege of being able to turn to God in prayer about all of that. To do that.
Yeah. And what we had as well on Sunday night was a reminder of the end of Galatians and Galatians 6, verse 2, carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ.
Absolutely.
And so that desire to say, actually, you're walking through the valley, and I'm going to come alongside with you, and I'm going to put my arm around you. I'm going to help you get through there, and in turn, I know that someone else is going to come and do that for me when I need it. And that, that is an amazing picture, demonstration of God's family, God's church at work, isn't it? His desire to bear one another's burdens.
Yeah. I mean, God is still that God.
Yeah.
God is still that God. So, you know, Christians, go and be those people, go and be those Christians, be those churches.
You mentioned earlier, Idris, about your role thinking strategically about how palliative care is arranged, is delivered throughout Wales. And these next couple of questions sort of touch into that. Sort of, is effective palliative care available to all? For example, what about cases of severe ME or chronic fatigue syndrome? So it's or other conditions you wouldn't necessarily immediately assume will need palliative care. Is the increasing cost of palliative care a driver behind politicians wanting to legalise assisted suicide?
Okay, I mean, on the last part of that question, I do get to deal a little bit with some politicians and certainly officials in government. And I've got to say, I haven't encountered any in this conversation in recent times for whom that's a consideration. And I'm reassured by that. And I would want to have firmly worded conversations if I did. There are, however, other players in society who do consider that. And you may have seen stuff in recent months in the national press where prominent writers and opinion formers have sought to say, do you know what, it's okay for it to become a duty to consider whether your life should end because that's better for everybody else. And you know, I would absolutely flatly reject that. I think it, just on the surface, it seems a bit horrific. But it also seems entirely to fly in the face of everything we know about God's will in the lives of people. And not least, you've summed it up beautifully, that excerpt from Galatians. That's not the response that I think we should be encouraging other people to make in light of their changed and maybe diminished circumstances. But I haven't encountered any politicians who talk openly that way, and I'm glad to say that. I disagree with some of them profoundly on this question, but the ones I've encountered at least are at least motivated by some sense of compassion. I merely disagree, and I disagree very strongly with them, about what we should do. Motivated by compassion, I'm not going to accuse them of being monsters of that kind of ilk. But you know, is palliative care available to everybody who needs it? I mean, I wish that it were. It is in principle. There's nothing to stop it being. But actually, the scale and the reach of the right kind of support. And I'm not thinking here just about palliative care specialists who do a small part of the palliative care that's needed, but the response of the health and care system as a whole. There's no condition where, you know, there's a label that says, well, you definitely can't have palliative care for this. But we know, we absolutely know that not everybody who needs elements of palliative care in their lives gets it when they need it. And so, you know, the big strategic effort is to change that. And so we're looking for the opportunities to do that. And I could bore you, but I won't for this conversation with how we want to go about that. Suffice to say, it's not nearly as it should be. And we need a mass collective public effort to change that.
And that's often what you will hear, I suppose, is what one of the concerns about a bill such as the one coming before Parliament is that if this was passed, it would affect the delivery of palliative care, that even if it's not the intention, that it would make it harder, that maybe less money would be available, that maybe there would be less emphasis on it. Do you buy into that?
Well, there's certainly some risk of that. I wouldn't quite buy into it as a certainty. It used to be believed that you couldn't do the two alongside each other. I mean, I have to accept that there are some countries that do elements of both alongside each other, but it would certainly be a pretty colossal distraction for those who are trying to improve the one thing if they were then having to devote some of their time being wheeled out to find a way to do this thing allegedly safely. If I was asked for advice on how to do that, I wouldn't want to shirk it because then they might end up doing it less than safely. But I can't do two things at the same time. So there's some risk of distraction, certainly. But I think the other thing that's relevant is that if you're facing distress, distressing symptoms or a lack of support, and you're facing the situation where the provision of the right kind of palliative care, whether that's from a specialist or whoever it be from, the right kind of palliative care isn't yet available to you, even if it's available in principle, well, that's a big, big steer on how you're going to see whether your life should end. You're much more likely to see that being a thing that's necessary if you haven't got the care you do need in order to live well. So it's one of the concerns that, and again, it was expressed, I think, in the Senate the other day. One of the real concerns is you can't safely introduce this kind of legal measure without having everything else in play. Mm. Now, I talked about housing adaptations for people living with disabilities. That's a particular concern in Canada. It could well be a concern here. So there's lots of things that might need to be in place. Now, I would question even then whether this thing of ending people's lives can be done safely. I think it probably can't. In fact, I don't think doing it safely is a thing. But it certainly can't be if you're having people effectively coerced by society to go for a life-ending decision because they're not being helped to live well. You know, we hear this slogan about dying with dignity. Can we please help people to live with dignity, maybe? Now, that's a plea to the us as individuals, it's a plea to the church, but it's a plea to society and governments as well. Mm-hmm. We're not doing nearly enough that would actually help people in the face of illness to live well with dignity at the moment. And there's a lot more that could be done, and it's really relevant to this question.
And the next two questions that we've got, actually, we have touched on a lot so far, unsurprisingly maybe, but also pick up on that theme, really. So the uncompassionate attitude and care towards hospitalised elderly patients can result in their untimely demise. What message is sent if this bill is passed? Now, obviously, that's making a statement there that I suppose we'd kind of think about. But what would you say your reflections has been on culture, even culture maybe within the medical profession, have you noticed a change over the last, 10, 20 years?
I think it's really difficult to capture. And so I would have to confront that question with a bit of humility, because different people's experiences are different. What we certainly see, though, is that you have staff. I mean, superb. If I close my eyes, I can see some of the behaviours of some of the people I've had the privilege of working with over the years, now and in past years. Just outstanding people with outstanding impulses to act in compassion and to find a way to help people, whoever they are and whatever they're living with. And yet who, in a system increasingly under pressure, are constrained in doing that in a way that makes it much harder and sometimes makes it fail. And sometimes those good people even end up behaving in ways that they would never have expected, and ways worse than they would ever have expected. So, systems under strain, they do often fail, in spite of the wonderful people working in them, fail to deliver an experience of compassion to some people who need to be in receipt of the care. And it's quite simply true that some people, partly in response to that, think, I wish I could just die. Mm. I believe quite strongly that there has to be a better way to respond to that than saying, yes, you might as well. There has to be a better way to respond to it. And I think that better way of responding to it encompasses finding ways. Now, these are difficult questions. There's a real logistical as well as political challenge here. But finding ways that system can actually make that more consistent, person-centred, human, compassionate response to where this person's at in their needs to live, so that they're not almost pushed into the feeling that they need to die. Now, there are ways to do that, and we need to keep working at them.
Yeah. And I think just a word on healthcare professionals. It, as you said, it is a, maybe it's always been a difficult job to take on, maybe now as much as ever, really. And as you said, most palliative care is not done by palliative care specialists, not done by people like us who have had the luxury of the training, who get to surround ourselves with other people who do it and bounce ideas off each other and mutually supported. They're at the coalface looking after patients with often sometimes serious illnesses, difficult symptoms. And that's a really, really hard place to be a lot of the time. And my experience of those not working in palliative care as a specialty, but delivering palliative care, is making the absolute best of the resources that they have available to them, just wishing they had more resources more time, more staff, more energy, more tools at their disposal, really. And so I think it is, if you know, this question here is about the uncompassionate attitude and care, and I think sometimes it can feel as though you're being cared for in the wrong ways, and maybe there are examples where that does happen, but often it's a result of people trying to do an awful lot with not very much.
I think that's absolutely right, and there's empowerment as well, empowerment and a sense of permission to do the right thing, which your moral instinct is telling you is what's needed, maybe doing something a bit different from what we usually do because that's what this person needs at this time. So we have to be supporting people in doing that. And look, if you work in a care home, some of what you do will be providing palliative care. If you're an oncologist, some of what you do will be providing palliative care. If you're a physiotherapist working with people with end-stage lung disease, some of what you do will be providing palliative care. It may not be called that. That doesn't matter, but that is an element of what you're doing. And so we have to be supporting this vast army of people. And a lot of them will say it's one of the most difficult things, but a lot of people I talk to will say it's also one of the best things they get to be doing. Yeah. But it's got to be supported in the right way, equipped in the right way for that to work. And then everybody benefits.
And I suppose that doesn't also mean that if you are that person in the middle of that hospital ward, or that the family member who's experiencing care that maybe isn't meeting the mark, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be speaking up about that, even though you might think, actually, these people are just trying to do their best. I think it's really important to have these voices. It's so much better when we can speak openly and honestly about times and ways that we haven't got it right.
Yeah, it's huge that. And the individual staff who want to do the right thing, they are often equipped to do that better with that bit of reflection on the experience of the people they're doing it for. But at least as importantly as that, system leaders and people making big political decisions, they need to hear, and we need to have the systems in place so that they do hear what that experience is like, because that's what tells us the things that need to change.
Absolutely. Look, we have to sort of bring this to a close, but we've got one final question, and I'll just read it out, really. Upon reflection on the book of Job, is suffering not part of life and a test of our faith in God? Now, maybe unfair, I've left this right for the end. We could probably do another series of recordings on this. What would you say about this?
I mean, look, as you say, suffering is a big and complex issue, and the Bible as a whole has plenty to say about it, and the book of Job has plenty to say about it. There's no doubt that it is a part of life. We know that just by looking around us, even without opening your Bible, you know that, but you see plenty specifically on it in the Bible. There's no doubt, I think, that for the believer, that suffering can test one's faith. But if we look at the book of Job, and you look particularly at how it, I'm going to say two things about the book of Job. I'm no theologian and I don't have it open in front of me. And, you know, we could talk for hours, couldn't we, with books open in front of us. But two things let me highlight. One is that Job, we don't know the detail of exactly when he lived and exactly what he knew, but we know that he loved God. So he's someone we can regard for in our terms as a believer. And we know that what causes the suffering in his life is a vicious enemy who loves to cause chaos in the lives of God's people. And that's the devil. And the book of Job's very clear about it. But look, what do you see? What do you see in Job, and what do you see in the Bible as a whole? He is no match for God. He is no match for the Lord Jesus Christ, who we now know in detail that perhaps Job didn't, what Jesus has done and what that means then in the life of the believer. What does that then tell us? It tells us it reminds us that God is sovereign. Where do you turn? You turn to God. And this ultimately, of course, is what Job does. Secondly, and it's partway through the book, there's this scene, I think it's chapter 19, this scene where Job is under attack and all his friends. Incidentally, Job's friends, you know what they did before they said all these unhelpful things that fill about 30 chapters of the book? Before they did that, they sat and listened. They went to be with him in his suffering. They didn't ignore him. They didn't say, oh, he probably won't want to see us. They went to be with him. I said I'd bring out two things. This is a third thing. They went to be with him and they sat in silence for a week, willing to give time, willing to spend time, not coming out with smart ideas. Oh, you should go and do this. You could go and do that. Their first impulse was to sit and be and listen and just to get alongside their friend. Now, they then went off and said some really unhelpful stuff, and it's all in the book. But their first impulse, just to sit and be and to listen. Now, think about that. But in the middle of this, Job is feeling actually a bit attacked now by his three friends, as well as by the world around him. And everything's terrible. And there's the storm clouds. And there's this scene partway through chapter 19, or this couple of verses, where out of the blue, it's almost like the storm clouds have parted. And he has this vision, almost. I mean, my word, not the word in the text. I know that my Redeemer lives. And at the end, he will stand upon the earth and I will see him with my own eyes. I am not another. And the rest, and a lot of the rest of the book is still really, really difficult. And then God deals with him more openly towards the end of the book. Now, I know that my Redeemer lives. I don't know that Job knew that the Lord Jesus Christ was his Redeemer, that that's the name he would have been able to give him. But he knew he had a Redeemer. Well, so can every believer. And we know plenty more than Job knew. What does Job tell us then? Yeah, there's going to be suffering. It may not be like Job's. It may be different. It may be worse. It may be less. Okay, God is sovereign. And any believer, I know that my Redeemer lives. Who do you turn to? Well, that tells you who you turn to. Anyone who is wanting to understand how Christians see this stuff. Well, if you turn, as we've talked about plenty, if you turn to the Lord Jesus Christ in repentance and faith, then you can say that just as surely as Job did, in the face of whatever it is that you suffer. That's what the book of Job tells us.
And coming back, I suppose, finishing off where you mentioned earlier, how is it that in the face of what so often is very, very difficult suffering, pain, whether physical, emotional, spiritual, that people face when they have life shortening illnesses, how on earth could I live through that? How on earth could I face the next day? How on earth could my life be worth living, have any meaning if I wasn't able to do this or I was having to face this?
It's not the
complete answer, but to know that the Lord Jesus is alive and that one day he will stand upon the earth and he will make all things new means that in the darkness, in the storm clouds, we can reach out and we can keep going. And that doesn't mean that we as onlookers, we as friends, neighbors, healthcare professionals, shouldn't be trying to do everything we can to make that suffering better, to mitigate it. It doesn't mean that we say, well, your Redeemer lives, so we're gonna disappear off. No, it's the complete opposite as Christians, where we are, knowing that the Lord Jesus lives, trying to extend our God's compassion to them. But it does mean that whatever you go through, nothing can diminish your dignity. Nothing can take it away. Nothing can extinguish the candle of meaning from your life, even if it is impossible for you to see at this moment in time, because Jesus is alive and he one day will stand upon the earth.
That's exactly it. And you know, he himself told his followers that they should seek with the people around them, seek to alleviate the suffering they found in other people's lives. I mean, as you say, it's really abundantly clear. But that's not the end of the story. And the suffering that can't be mitigated isn't the end of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That seems like a good place for us to stop. It's been really, really great to chat. Thank you so much for your time and allowing us to fire all these questions at you. Hopefully it's been helpful for you listening in. But just want to say thank you again, Dr. Idris Baker.
Well, Anthony, thank you. And thank you for all the questions that have got our juices flowing.
All the best. Cheerio.